If Lewis is the great champion of mere Christianity in the 20th century, you'd be hard-pressed to find anyone in the 19th century who was more noted as a champion of mere Christianity than Moody.
Welcome to All About Jack and C.S. Lewis podcast. I'm William O'Flaherty from EssentialCSLewis.com. And today I'm just playing the role of director and producer for a very different edition of All About Jack. Normally I share material more directly related to C.S. Lewis, but that's not the case today. Let me explain. Today I'm sharing an interview I asked Gina D'Alfonso to conduct on my behalf with Kevin Belmonte about his new book called D.L. Moody, A Life, Innovator, Evangelist, World Changer. While we know of no direct influence Moody had on Lewis, we do know that Moody advocated what Lewis would later call mere Christianity. And as you may be aware, Lewis did not invent the term. Rather, he borrowed it from a Protestant clergyman named Richard Baxter, who was from the 17th century. Personally, I was not aware of how fascinating the life of D.L. Moody was until reading Kevin's book. In the show notes at EssentialCSLewis.com, or on Podbean, where you got this episode, you will find links to other interviews I've done with Kevin that include an essay chat and a book he previously wrote about the life of G.K. Chesterton, who greatly influenced C.S. Lewis. Also in the show notes are links to a series that Gina D'Alfonso co-hosted with me about Lewis and women.
Kevin, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Congratulations. I hear the book is doing very well. It's gotten accolades from Christianity Today. I saw a really good review in World. It seems to be a hit.
Yeah, no, I'm very grateful. It's often a challenge to get through some of them out there in cyberspace, but no, I've been very grateful for the kind reviews that have come in. Thank you.
You clearly have a great admiration for D.L. Moody. What was it that first drew you to him as a potential subject for a biography?
Well, I was actually writing a book about Billy Graham for my British publisher, Day One, a few years back, and I learned that Dr. Graham had taken time from a preaching tour in 1950, I think it was April of that year, and went out to Northfield, where D.L. Moody is buried, and made a point of going to his graveside with some of the folk who were traveling with him and having a time of prayer there by Moody's graveside. And he wanted to honor Moody's memory. But then I think there was also, in terms of symbolism, if you will, a kind of a passing of the mantle, because so many of the things that Moody did, going to theaters, going to large halls, venues where the gospel hadn't been taken, those are the kinds of things that Dr. Graham picked up on and have been hallmarks of his ministry over the years. So that bit of connection with Moody's life and legacy and the thought of wanting to stop by the graveside and honor his memory and then try and carry some of the things that Mr. Moody did forward, that really registered with me. And I also, when I began to see who Moody was, I knew a bit about him before, but when I began to undertake that journey of discovery, as they say, I began to discover things about him that I didn't know, that I didn't expect to find, and his meeting with Abraham Lincoln, for one. I had no idea that he and Lincoln had met on the eve of Lincoln's election for the first time as president in 1860. These kinds of things, his work with the children in the slums of Chicago, I was hooked pretty early on and just wanted to do a lot of digging and see if I could put all the pieces of the puzzle together.
So what would you say are some of your favorite qualities about him?
Oh, it's a long list. I'll try and run through them quickly if I could. I think the first thing, Gina, would be that he was someone who was vibrantly alive. There was something about his faith, even though he lived, you know, well over 100 years ago, something about his faith that seems very timeless, very winsome, very compelling, very genuine. You can read his sermons, and because he spoke for the person on the street, as Billy Graham used to say, he put the cookies on the lower shelf. His sermons read wonderfully well. All these years later, you can dust them off, as it were, and it seems like you might have just had them preached a week or so ago. They really have a timeless quality about them. But But then his personal qualities too. His faith was genuine and humble. He had his faults, to be sure, but he was a person who had a real teachable heart. That's another phrase that has just come to my mind over and over again as I've thought about your questions. And the idea that he had a teachable heart, the idea that as he went along in his journey of faith, if he did make mistakes, he never made them twice. If he needed to ask forgiveness, he did that. His willingness to sit at the feet of people who were better educated than he was and to learn from them, those things really sort of won me over. But then I think, too, as a writer, Moody had a great gift that people don't often realize at first blush, and it was a cradle gift, something that God gave him and he developed over time. But he always had a great gift for casting word pictures. One of them is a really neat one that I like a lot. He said, "Truth never grows old. Truth is as young today as it ever has been. Talk of old truths wearing out. Don't you enjoy the rays of the same sun which has been shining these thousands of years?" Now, that's the kind of thing that you get from Moody.
You touched on this a little bit earlier. You have some great stories in the book about Moody going out and to the slums and rounding up the poor children from some of the worst neighborhoods, really, to take them to church and to Christian meetings where they got, many of them, I'm sure, got some of the first Christian teaching they'd ever had. Where do you think he got the drive to do that and to keep on doing it?
Well, I don't think you have to look any further, really, than his own upbringing. He was one of nine children. His father died tragically when he was just 4 years old. And Moody was one of nine children. His mother raised them all. She was counseled to farm the children out to relations and to friends and let them help with the work of raising. And she had a real streak of Yankee grit and determination. And she said, "Not as long as I have these two hands." And she tackled that enormous task, being a single mom way back in mid-19th century, bringing up nine children in great poverty. Thankfully, she had a very caring pastor and people in the parish that kind of came alongside her. But Moody never forgot the challenges of what it was like growing up and having to scrape and to work so hard for every penny. The bill payer, the tax collector, they were never far from the door. So that notion of being in great need and not being able, in his case, to have as much formal education as he would have liked. He only had about 4 or 5 years at the most, and it was pretty spotty of formal education. He always had to be working on farms, doing a lot of heavy manual labor, so schooling was a bit spotty for him. I think when he grew up, and by the time he got out to Chicago, he was only 19 when he got there, but he had incredible gifts as a business person. He had gone to work at 17 in his uncle's store in Boston and had been a huge success. Decided to strike out for Chicago, wanted to go out on his own, got out there, and he was well on his way to making the equivalent of what would be $1 million today. He was just one of a group of very gifted young business people who all, they lived in the same boarding house, and they were coming up through the ranks together, and they all put their money on Moody as the one who was going to make it. Well, Moody, he had been a Christian by this time, but he was still very young in the faith. And as I say, he was only 19. And he was looking for something to do. He wanted to give back because he'd been given a lot in the church setting that he knew when he was very young in the faith. They'd listen to him talk. They'd hear how poor his grammar was. And they really didn't want him to do anything. But they said, "Well, look, if you don't mind getting up a class by yourself, you can do that." And he went right out into the slums and gathered up all the children he could find and filled the pews. And they didn't know what to do. And so Moody, all on his own, began this mission school. They started in an abandoned train car. Then they were in an abandoned saloon. Finally, they got the use of a hall to use. But Moody, I don't think he ever forgot where he came from. And he was raised in a rural setting. But if you look at the poverty he knew, if you look at the hunger that he knew what it was like to have, if you knew what it was like to be fatherless, all those things stayed with Moody. And so when he saw young people in Chicago that weren't all that different than he was, something about their situation really spoke to his heart with great power.
You've touched on Moody's lack of theological training, and that's something you touch on in the book as well. Do you think it was in any way a hindrance to him?
Yeah, I could see where some people might think that. It's interesting, though, looking at that question and giving it some thought before we talk together this evening. My mind went right away to something that Lord Shaftesbury said about Moody. And of course, he was Britain's great reformer in the 19th century, and he knew Moody, went to hear him many times. And Shaftesbury was the one who expressed gratitude that Moody had never been educated at a place like Oxford, yeah, one of the great universities of England or America, that kind of thing. And he realized something. Shaftesbury was insightful in this way. He realized that Moody wouldn't have been who he was if he'd been educated in a place like that. His gifts would have risen to the top, but he just had that wonderful gift for public speaking, for telling stories, relating to people wherever they were in their walk of life. But Shaftesbury, I think I would defer to him in that respect, that Moody, we would have lost something special, I think, if Moody had gotten an Oxford education. But I hasten to say that Moody himself placed a very high value on education, and we need to remember that he founded four schools, and someone who only had a fourth or fifth grade education ended up founding four schools, which is remarkable. You know, you mentioned why did he go into the slums of Chicago? I think that the reasons why he did that were very much in play when he founded the schools, and he said, you know, the object of these Northfield schools is to help young men and women of very limited means get an education such as would have done me good when I was their age. I want to help them into lives that will count the most for the cause of Christ. Yeah, no, I did want to say too, with regard to Moody's lack of theological training, I think mentioning Lincoln is helpful here because with respect to their lack of education, they were very much alike. Lincoln had about a year and a half of formal education. Moody had four or five, probably closer to four. So they had to make up for it the rest of their lives, and indeed they both did so. And in Moody's case, what was really remarkable, he had this program of self-education. He would get up at 4 or 5 every morning and read and study. He did this from the time he was converted until God called him home, really, in his early 60s. So he was always reading. He was a voracious reader. Just a quick example, Charles Spurgeon gave him a complete set of his works, and Moody read them all, cover to cover. So, pretty extraordinary commitment as a reader. But then, getting back to Moody's teachable heart, he was always picking the brains of people that he met and he knew well who were better educated. And he would say something like, "Give me something out of your heart. Tell me something about Christ." And then, when he was having dinner at the restaurant there at the YMCA in Chicago, which he helped to get established and build, he would ask his friends as they were sitting around the table, you know, "What has been your best thought today?" And so he was always gathering information. His son-in-law has this wonderful image of Moody carrying around this little notepad, and it was a notepad that was set aside for what he called his nuggets, his little bits of gold that he would get from his friends. And whenever he heard something that struck his imagination or something that he realized he should look at in more detail later, he was always writing it down. But then I think the second thing about his program of self-education, as it were, when he was converted, as I say, he got up early to read in the morning. But then he also had, in later years, he had marvelous friends who would undertake book reading for him. They would read books that they thought he should know about. They would mark out passages, and they would even outline the books for him because he had so many demands on his time, so that he was able to really get the heart of a good book very quickly through the kindness of friends. And because of that kindness, because of his commitment himself to read through what had been given him, he became a very widely read man. And indeed, the principal of the prep school that he founded for boys, Mal Herman, picked up on that. This gentleman, who was Dr. Cutler, said that when he knew Moody in Moody's later years, he always looked at him as being one of the most thoroughly well-read people he'd met. Any topic, he said, theological, philosophical, he was well-informed about science. So really a pretty extraordinary thing for Moody to have just made that lifelong commitment to improving himself and bettering his mind.
Now, in the book, you share several glowing media reports about Moody. What kind of reaction do you think that the media would have to him today, along with other societal institutions and schools like Oxford and Yale?
Yeah, it's interesting. You should say that Moody had all kinds of connections to Yale. Of course, his two sons went there and descendants have gone. But they want to have me come down this fall and give a talk there at the Divinity School. So I can sort of give you a modern case study and say that in the case of Yale, they're very interested in Moody. And I can also speak to the Oxford side of it, because 3 years ago, I was asked to lecture there at Keble College in Oxford, and they wanted me specifically to speak about D.L. Moody. So I've lectured in both places and taught there, and Moody has been well received in both places. So what's old is new again, so to speak.
How about the New York Times? Do you think they would like him now as much as they did then? I think it was the New York Times that you mentioned.
I did, Gina. That's right. It was the New York Times. Yeah, I've thought about that since I read your question over for the first time. I wonder if he would be. I think because they have a sense of their own archives, and they have a wonderful archive there that I made great use of when I was writing my book. It's a tremendous resource. I'm sure that if they were to write an article about Moody, one of the first things that they would have one of their correspondents do is look to see what the Times might have said about him in years past. So if that were any kind of a point of reference for them, I think they would realize that there were things about Moody that commanded the respect of the paper and its writers back in Moody's lifetime and not too long after that. But I think, too, with regard to the kinds of things that Moody was doing, his work as an educator and as a philanthropist, I think, would be very compelling for a large media sort of platform like the Times, or perhaps maybe even Time Magazine. I'm trying to think of some of the ones that I know have written about him. But to know that Moody, by design, went to the West and brought Native American children out to his schools when he founded them so that they could have an education they wouldn't have otherwise. The fact that the children of slaves were being educated. The fact that Moody, the first of his four schools, was a school for young women, and that he didn't even wait for the first building to be completed. He welcomed these 25 girls into his home, he and his wife Emma, with their three children. They welcomed these girls. They had a wing added onto their home temporarily, and the school began right around his dining room table. These kinds of things about Moody, when you realize that what was driving him was the desire to give disadvantaged young people a shot at an education they wouldn't otherwise have. When I've been talking to people, people I meet in the library, people I meet in my travels here in New England, I begin to tell them about the most recent book I'm working on, and I mention these kinds of things. It really seems to capture their imagination. So I think in those regards, I think papers like the New York Times, magazines like Time Magazine might find that praiseworthy. I think that he would probably come in for a bit of skepticism because we live in an age that's highly skeptical about religion. But I think if Moody's story were looked at in detail, and the fact that he'd come out of such disadvantaged circumstances himself and had become an educator and a philanthropist who refused to touch any of the millions of dollars that came through his fundraising. He was tireless. The fact that he was entitled to quite large royalties because of the book that he owned the rights to, the Moody Sankey Hymn Book, the fact that he refused to touch a penny when so many modern-day religious leaders have had a fall from grace, it breaks the heart to say it, but no hint of scandal ever attached itself to Moody. Dr. Lyle Dorset looked at his life in great detail, just wanting to make sure that he'd done a thorough investigation of Moody's personal life and his integrity as a person involved in ministry. No hint of scandal has ever been able to attach itself to Moody. Errors in judgment, yes, but no hint of scandal, no wrongdoing. He was an admirable father and husband, faithful to his wife. Those kinds of things, I think, still have power all these years later.
You have an interesting quote in the book from the Catholic world. It says that Moody, quote, avowed such strong repugnance to all bonds of faith made by creed or dogma, He believed that a simple promise to be loyal to Christ was all sufficient, end quote. Do you think this is an accurate assessment?
Yeah, actually, I think the Catholic world pretty much hit the nail on the head. In essence, yes. And it really speaks to Moody's Mere Christianity. And that, I think, was something that just really caught me by surprise in a good way when I was researching his life. I mean, I knew that he brought together people from different faith traditions, but that he was so explicit and so public and so committed over 40 years of ministry to reaching across the great divides that were there, denominationally speaking, and had many Catholic friends who admired him. The fact that he received a tribute like that from the Catholic world says a great deal to me. And he returned the favor. He had a wonderful saying from one of his sermons. He said, "Catholics have the same Savior as the Protestants, one shepherd, one Christ." And to reach out a hand of friendship like that, the divide between Catholics and Protestants in the 19th century was just such a huge chasm. But for Moody to be a bridge builder in that way, really, it caught my attention. But then I wanted to pick up on what you said about the creed. I actually have a quote where Moody references this whole notion of not being committed so much to a creed as you would be committed to the person of Christ. He spoke about that, and he said, "I like a man to be able to give a reason for the faith that's in him." And then he went on to explain what he meant. He said, "Not belief in a creed only. A man may have a creed and know Christ. A creed is all right in its place, but if you live on creeds, you will never get a living Christ. Suppose a friend should ask me to dine with him. To reach his house, I must go on the street leading to his home, but if I do not go into his house, I don't get my dinner. Now, a creed is the road or street, very good as far as it goes, but if it doesn't take us to Christ, it is worthless. God doesn't ask you to believe a creed, but a person, and that person is Jesus Christ." So he spoke very explicitly to the question as you posed it to me, and I wanted to share that with you.
You used the term mere Christianity just now. So do you think that this idea of Moody's sort of squares with C.S. Lewis's vision of mere Christianity?
I think it's very complementary, and I would go so far to say, and I'll explain why in just a moment, because there are actually seven facets of Moody's life and ministry that were explicitly committed to mere Christianity, and I'll walk through them very quickly. But yes, on the face of it, Moody's emphasis on mere Christianity was very complementary to what we understand of Lewis, reaching out a hand of friendship across the denominational landscape, focusing on essentials of the faith, the first things of the faith. Moody and Lewis would have agreed with each other wholeheartedly there. And I would go so far as to say that if Lewis is the great champion of mere Christianity in the 20th century, you'd be hard-pressed to find anyone in the 19th century who was more noted as a champion of mere Christianity than Moody. And one doesn't have to take my word for it. You look at the four schools that Moody founded. They were, in his phrase, undenominational, or better, interdenominational in terms of their worship life, their focus, their orientation as schools. And by the time he died in 1899, there were 5,000 young people who'd come through those schools. So in terms of schools, you have an emphasis on mere Christianity. But then you have the books that Moody published as part of what were called the Moody Colportage Library. It's a bit of a mouthful, but it was a whole series of titles, several dozen. But they, by design, these books were described as undenominational, thoroughly evangelistic for all classes of readers. And they were published in the millions in his lifetime. It's incredible how many copies of these books sold. Of course, we think about mere Christianity selling in the millions in the 20th century. So there you kind of have a direct linkage in a literary sense. Moody was publishing books that, by design, were committed to a mere Christian outlook and emphasis. But then you have the Northfield Summer Conferences, and these were held for two decades before Moody died in 1899, and the description of these conferences that Moody's Irish-born son-in-law gave, A.P. Fitt, was really astonishing. He just underlined the mere Christianity aspect in bright colors. He said these conferences were noted for their Catholicity, that was his word, and he said, "Not a single truth held by evangelical Christianity has failed of due honor People have been affected in every branch of the universal church. A bishop may be followed on the platform at Northfield by an unordained evangelist. And he said, but this means more than mere interdenominationalism. No sect or denomination is ever allowed to present a particular point or points of its difference. They all try to emphasize the essentials of evangelical Christianity. And Fitz said that no controversy arises to mar the sweetness of fellowship. And by his lights, there resulted a majestic harmony of affirmation. And then he closed with saying that he thought this was one great secret for the success of the Northfield conferences. And you had young people coming from Oxford and Cambridge in the UK, from all the Ivy League schools in the United States. Leaders came from all parts of the world, really, as far away as Asia and Africa, to be a part of these things. And so for mere Christianity to not only be a centerpiece, but such a draw, such a powerful attraction for all these leaders. And then very quickly, Moody put out his own wonderful book called 1001 Thoughts from My Library. It's a marvelous anthology. And he had readers who are represented in that book from all of the centuries of Christian history, right down to his time, and they crossed all the denominational traditions. They were all there, even mystics, which didn't often get a lot of press, as it were, among evangelically minded people. Moody had a deep and wide appreciation for all the streams of Christianity, and they're reflected in that book. But then you have people like Lyle W. Dorset saying that Moody saw no virtue in abolishing denominational distinctives. He carried an abiding aversion to focusing on what he considered non-essentials, and he disliked labeling, criticizing, and then breaking fellowship with brothers and sisters of different traditions. So, you know, there's a scholar weighing in who's just looked at Moody's life in great detail. And then you have the church that Moody himself founded, the Illinois Street Church, which after the Great Chicago Fire became the Chicago Avenue Church. They said in their own statement of polity, which Moody helped draft, this body of believers desires to be known only as Christians without reference to any denomination, yet regarding all who hold and preach the truth contained in our articles of faith as equally belonging to the same head of the church, and they're free to cooperate and unite. And it's a wonderful statement of church polity. And then last of all, you have the dedication bronze for the Memorial Chapel at Mount Hermon. It was the last building built before Moody died. They wanted to honor him for his 60th birthday. He refused to let them put his name anywhere on the place. The only thing he would allow is for this plaque to be placed there. And the plaque reads very simply. You can see it there today. It's very moving. It said, this chapel was erected by the united contributions of Christian friends in Great Britain and the United States for the glory of God and to be a perpetual witness to their unity in the service of Christ. So for all these reasons, Moody's commitment to mere Christianity was sweeping, it was pervasive, and it was a hallmark of his ministry for the better part of 40 years. So quite a remarkable thing.
As we finish up, do you have any more stories that you'd like to share about Moody?
I do, and it's a marvelous story that I used as an appendix for my book, told by his son Paul, who was president of Middlebury College, a distinguished graduate of Yale, distinguished educator and leader in his own right. Paul writes about this wonderful tribute in 1914, about 15 years after his father had died. He was asked to reflect, you know, what was it like to be the son of such a great father? And it's not very long to read. I'll share it with you. It's just so moving. I wouldn't want to do anything less than justice to Paul Moody's wonderful prose. He said, if one whose life had been spent on the slopes of some great mountain, the streams of which had watered his fields, even as the shoulders and ridges protected him from the winds, should awake one morning to find that in the night the whole mountain had been removed, his sensation, I imagine, would not be altogether dissimilar to ours that December morning when we tried to realize that the past had suddenly stepped forward and claimed the present. For some of us, life has never been quite the same, nor can it ever be. But this is an impression, and recollections are more to the point. When I was a small boy, I was on one occasion quite unintentionally disobedient in respect to going to bed. Father spoke with an unwonted abruptness and severity, and I sought my bed crying. I was hardly there before he was kneeling by my side, sobbing like a child, imploring my pardon for his impatience and harshness. The strength which enabled him to humble himself to his little boy, combined with such tenderness, seemed then and now both wonderful and Christ-like. I believe I owe more to the memory of this incident than anything else in my life.
Wow, that's really beautiful and very moving, as you say. Well, again, the title of the book is D.L. Moody, A Life, and the author is Kevin Belmonte. And Kevin, thanks very much.
Thank you, Gina. I really appreciate it.
Thanks also goes to you, the listener, for taking the time to listen to this podcast from All About Jack. Again, I'm William O'Flaherty from EssentialCSLewis.com, where I normally have a show very directly related to Lewis. But Kevin Belmonte is such a gifted writer and a previous guest on the show that I felt compelled to share his latest book. Be sure to stop by EssentialCSLewis.com for a wide variety of material about Lewis that includes a daily fact, quote, and quiz question, a spotlight on other great free resources about Lewis online, and very special articles, and of course, previous podcast episodes.